This is Dr. Laura Coggins of the Vietnam Archive at Texas Tech University, initiating an oral history interview with Lieutenant Colonel John Gary Morris. Today's date is the 31st of August, 2005. I am in the interview room in the Special Collections building on the campus of Texas Tech in Lubbock, and the colonel is speaking to me by telephone from his home, another part of Texas. Colonel, first of all, good morning.
Good morning.
I want to thank you for taking the time to participate in the Oral History Project. It's extremely important to us that we have your contribution, and we're grateful for your time.
Honored.
Thank you. I want to confirm that it's all right with you, first of all, that I call you Gary.
Yes.
Okay. And also that we make this interview available both in audio and transcription form to researchers through the Vietnam Archive.
Yes.
Thanks, Gary. First of all, let's start off by finding out a little bit about where you hail from and when you were born. Can you tell me a little bit about where you were born and when?
1942, Houston, Texas. From there, I moved to Dallas and eventually ended up in Irving at age four,
uh-huh.
which has been my hometown basically for the rest of my life, except for the stint after I came home from Vietnam, and I spent 7 years there after the war, and then after 7 years, I moved back to Irving, and I've resided there ever since.
Where were you living after Vietnam?
In Denton, Texas.
Oh, okay. So you're Texas through and through.
Yes.
Okay. Gary, tell me a little bit about yourself growing up and your parents. Did you live with your family, and what did your parents do?
Mother was a teacher. My father was a self-starter. I admired him greatly. He started his own business, which was lasted up until almost 45 years,
mm-hmm.
and of which I sold later on. When I did sell it, it was the fourth oldest business in town in Irving, and he started with two people, and we ended with three people. And so he started it. He had no credit. And
mm-hmm.
as I look back, and it was quite something. He was Czech. His parents came over from Czechoslovakia.
Mm-hmm.
He was probably, in my mind, as I look back, he's deceased, was probably the most unusual person and the most fascinating person I ever known in my life.
Really?
Extremely patriotic. He would talk about it to friends,
mm-hmm.
but he was, I would say he could come close to as John Wayne as I've ever seen, except that he didn't talk about it. His favorite person was Tom Landry.
Tom Landry, the football coach?
Yeah, he came close to being a Tom Landry. He was active in the Methodist Church.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't talk about it much. He taught Sunday school class for years. As a Czech, he was extremely protective of his family.
Mm-hmm.
As a European parent, praise was little. Physical hugging and kissing and all that was unheard of.
Mm-hmm.
But the paddle was there.
Mm-hmm.
Not much talking about whatever, other than you do your schoolwork, and if you didn't do what you were supposed to do, you got busted.
Mm-hmm.
But extremely protective, he told me about my grandfather, who came over, and he came over from the old country he left there because he was at the age in which the Czechoslovakia was going to draft him in the army,
mm.
and at that time, when you went in the army, you went in virtually for your life. I think it was 20 to 25 years servitude. So he came over the boat, and he started out in West Texas, where my father was from. And the thing I remember about my father, but he worked all his life. I saw a book that he gave to his granddaughter, that he would fill in the blank sort of space, and it asked you questions. And some of the things he said was, and it was very impressive upon me,
mm-hmm.
Is that what did you do most of your childhood? He said, I worked. What did you do for pastime? I worked.
Mm-hmm.
What was your favorite thing to do? Well, I swam I swam in this creek, you know, and he lived with seven brothers out in West Texas. It was an extremely hard life. His dad was a blacksmith. It was hard. All his brothers became alcoholics, with the exception of him. I don't know why he didn't. I guess because he was the oldest brother. Alcoholism was not unknown because out there they didn't have much water. And so being a Czech, they knew how to make their own brew. And I understand from my cousins that it wasn't that often, unoften, that they didn't get into the brew. And they drank a lot of it.
Whereabouts in West Texas were they?
Homerton, Texas, which is just southwest of Seymour, which is just southwest of Wichita Falls. They were such a wild bunch that he told me one time that they, when they came down to dinner time, and it was everyone for himself, at one time one of the brothers stuck a fork in another brother's head.
In his head?
In his head, and they took him off to Wichita Falls in some type of vehicle to have a doctor extract it and so forth. And they were just a wild bunch. Dad strongly believed in sports and schooling. He loved to read Latin. He graduated valedictorian of his class of four. He had a scholarship to Texas. He went down there. He didn't like it. It was too big, I think. He went to North Texas. I keep talking to him because he was most influential in my life. Mother was caring. She was a school teacher. She was there. She just didn't have that much contact with me. He was the one I was always trying to impress, and everything.
Now, where was she from?
She was from a little town. I forgot the name, but up on the other side of McKinney. On her side, I became a member of the SAR because back in her history, there was a member who was a great-great-great-great-grandfather who was in the Revolutionary War and who was wounded and fought in several engagements.
What was her name? What was your mom's maiden name?
Johnny Davenport.
Was her first name Johnny?
Johnny, too.
Was that legal? That was her legal name?
It was her legal name.
That was kind of hard.
Johnny Laverne Davenport. And my father, who was in the Revolutionary War, was named John Dick, D-I-C-K. I had several other grandfathers who fought in the War of 1812. And so...
What about the Civil War? Do you know anything about that?
No, I couldn't find anybody. But mother, I don't know. I grew up in a very patriotic family. I can remember lots of times playing Army. Did it all the time. All the time. I was playing Army. I don't know why. I just did it all the time. And
what about brothers and sisters?
I had a sister. We weren't terribly close. I did have a great effect on my life was I had a colleague from age four until I graduated from high school.
What was your dog's name?
Her name was Jill. And I loved that dog. And I was not here when she died. And it killed me. I still, I loved her so much that I named my firstborn after her. My daughter's name is Tara Jill Morris. And,
Well, I know that feeling.
It was horrendous.
Yes.
And, so, anyway, I was not good in school.
Were you not?
No.
Did that displease your dad?
Yeah, and at the time they didn't know anything about ADD. But I was ADD. If you go back and I found my old lessons and so forth, they all said, he needs to slow down, he needs to stay in his chair, you know. His riding is terrible, and he needs to slow down. Everything was fast, 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 and I can remember, fast, fast, fast. And I needed the medication. In fact, even all the way up through college, I worked on the principle of reading something three and four times. I overread. And if you looked at my book, it looked like a coloring book. I'd line it when one color would be yellow, and then I'd come back and line something else in black. And, you know, it was a coloring book.
Mm.
And I had a professor one time tell me, he said, Gary, you can tell me what color socks General Lee wore at the Battle of Gettysburg, but you can't tell me who won the battle. And therefore, I was a C-minus student, and I worked hard in school, and it was hard to prove to my parents that I was working hard.
Mm-hmm.
And so I got scolded a lot, and even in college, I was, and I had a scholarship to University of Dallas to play baseball, and I loved the game of baseball. My father loved it, and we played a lot in the backyard and
mm-hmm.
so forth. So anyway, I had no help in high school playing baseball. They didn't know anything about it. We had high school football coaches.
What high school did you go to?
Irving High School.
And about how many kids in your class?
Oh, 700.
So it was huge for that time.
I think it was that. I think that was, yeah, for that. And that was, yeah, but my graduating class was only like 300.
And what year did you graduate?
1960. And I just, baseball was my love.
Mm-hmm.
And
Did you follow all the... You know, were you a big fan of professionals?
Yeah, I was a Yankee fan.
Mm-hmm. And, yeah. You couldn't hardly help it back in those days.
No, and, and my drive was to be a first baseman for the New York Yankees, and I heard all this garbage about you could do anything you want to do all if you just tried hard enough. And in later years, I clarified it, if I may jump forward. I used to, with my artwork, I would go to the schools, and sometimes I'd be there with some professional basketball player or football player, and they'd always say this garbage, you know, hey, if you want it bad enough, you can get it, just try hard enough. And I always come up beside them, behind them, I say, well, you can try that, but you better have a backup.
Backup plan.
And I'd use the example that when I was a kid, I tried hard enough to be a first baseman for the New York Yankees, and finally one time I got to meet the first baseman for the New York Yankees, and I realized that guy weighed about 55 more pounds than I did. He stood about 8 inches taller than I did and hit a ball about 100 yards farther than I did. And there was no way I was going to play baseball for the New York Yankees. And I realized I better have a second plan. So you can try it, but, you know, have a backup, pal, you know.
Right. Well, we're... Were there, that's very good advice. Were you drawn to any particular subjects in school, in high school?
No, it was just, nothing.
Nothing?
Nothing, just baseball.
Just trying to get through it so you could get to the Yankees.
And then when I went to high school, college,
mm-hmm.
It was the same thing, just get through. And so I played my 4 years of college baseball at University of Dallas, and I guess it was probably the happiest 4 years of my life. I still think back to those days, the competition, the fun, the laughter, the extreme competition, and I was good. I had a national record with NAIA
mm-hmm.
for several years of stolen bases, and I just used to get on the bases, and we had a great coach. He, Coach Al Ogletree, he eventually ended up being the winningest coach in NCAA history, and he ended up in every Hall of Fame you could think of.
Huh.
And I helped him into the Texas Hall of Fame, Texas Baseball Hall of Fame. And we were just a bunch of kids that he was fortunately able to get, that didn't make it to the other colleges. And we would go, and we beat every Southwest Conference school.
Okay.
And we played a brand of ball that I would call it a combination of little ball, and we had a little bit of big ball. Little ball was hit, bunt, steel sort of thing.
Right.
And then we had a couple of guys who could go on patrols with big ball. They could hit the big ball. And Coach would let me and another guy who were extremely fast, if I may say,
mm-hmm.
and he would work at I don't guess you want to hear all this.
I sure do. Actually, I'm waiting to find out how many bases you stole.
Well, I stole 27 in one season, and we only had 29 games in one season.
Oh, my God.
See, we didn't play many games today. They played 60 and 70. Back then, we played 29.
Yep.
And I stole 27 straight without being thrown out. And so that was a record. Then nobody could broke that for several years. And we had situations, for example, he would let, I went to Coach one time, and I said, I got an idea if you let me try it. And he said, what's your idea? And I said, well, if me and Pat, who was the other, if we get on first and the other one gets on third, one of us, let's say I'm on first, let me walk off first and pretend I got myself caught off first. In other words, the pitcher will see I'm off, and I'll start back first, and I'll slip, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I really have control of my body,
mm-hmm.
okay? And so...
But you'll fake him out.
Huh?
You're going to fake him out.
Yeah, when he throws the ball mm-hmm. first, I'm actually going to take off toward second. I'm going to have a real good jump toward second. So when he starts chasing me down toward second, Pat's on third. He's going to take off toward home. Okay?
Right, got it.
And meanwhile, while he's taking off, he's going to chase me to second, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And while I'm going to second, he'll stop and look and see that Pat has already gone toward home. And Pat was fast enough that he could get into home plate before the throw was there, and I'd already be at second. And by the time the catcher got the ball at second, I was already halfway turned to third, and I'd go into third. So where you had a situation where you had a man at first and third, now you had a man scored, and I'd be at third base.
And you're sitting on third waiting.
Yeah, and the pitcher would be going, what the hell happened here? But it was all planned.
So what did Coach say?
Oh, you know, he just sat there and laughed. And the other guys go, what did they do? And we played, I guess, our biggest thrill. We played the universe. We played Fort Hood. Now, at that time, they were the services were drafting, you know.
Oh, sure.
And he drafted out of the military. Mm-hmm. I mean, and they drafted out of the majors. And we went down to play them in a tournament.
Mm-hmm.
2 years, and we beat them both 2 years. And they had guys on there that were playing for Philly, you know,
mm-hmm.
and they had the Yankees and the Dodgers, and they had Los Angeles. I mean, it was just unbelievable when we looked at the roster. And, you know, we're going to play these guys. You know, it was bad enough playing Baylor and all those guys,
mm-hmm.
and Pan Am. And they played, you know, we the first game we beat them, and we had a playoff. And then we played in the playoff. They played. These were men, okay? We were kids.
Right, right, right.
And they just, they played dirty. And I'd be on first. I played first. And these guys would come back in first, and they'd go for my foot, you know, when they drop pickoff.
And now, when you say that, what do you mean?
Well, when you... If the guy's on first base, he's got a hit, he's standing there.
Yep.
And the pitcher tries a pickoff, and he throws the ball back toward first. Well, he comes back toward first to step on second.
Yep.
To step on the bag.
Step on the bag, yeah.
Well, guess what?
They try to...
They'd step on my foot.
Right.
And with spikes.
Sure enough.
It hurt. And they'd bring blood, you know.
Sure enough.
And I wasn't going to say anything. And, you know, it happened 3 or 4 times. And I'd go over there, and we'd look down, and there'd be... You know, hell, I wouldn't even have a sock hardly at that point. It'd just be gone, you know. And we weren't going to say anything. So we would fight back on double plays in which if I was at first and the ground ball was hit to, for, you know what a double play is?
Yes.
And I would go in to second base. I wouldn't go into second base. I'd go at the shortstop. I mean, I would literally go out of my way, and I'd go in there, and while he's throwing in there, I'd go in there. Hoover's at second. We'd go in there and, you know, knock him silly, you know. And you could do it, and you could hurt them because if they were in the air, they got to come down. And they could come down wrong. And, well, there was a time I went, we were playing Baylor, and I slid in, and I didn't mean to hurt this guy. And I went under him. I just barely touched his toe with my foot, and he came down wrong. He broke his ankle, and he was a starting split end for the Baylor Bears, and he was out for the season. That's all, toe versus toes. Well, every time we went in to do something like that, they respected us. They wouldn't start a fight or anything. But later on in the game one time, they went too far.
What happened?
Well, they had a man on second, and we had and they hit a ground ball to shortstop. That got it. Well, he was right. You know, when you're that close, you know, to the ball, to the shortstop, well, you're not going to go to third because, you're standing right in front of him. You know, he's,
right. You reach out and
all
touch
over
him
to third base, but then you're out, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you look him back. Look him back towards second. Make him, make sure he goes back towards second. Then you throw to first. Well, this guy just took off toward third, and the third baseman was behind third. He's supposed to be ready to receive the ball. He bent over, gloved down, and this guy did what we call a stand-up slide. He tucked one leg under, put the other leg up so he could bring it down fast and stand up, and he raked Norman. He raked him from the top of his head all the way through the face, down through his chest with the spikes. And it was ugly. I mean, he went back, and all you could see was blood, and especially on his face. And, nobody did anything. And, we didn't, and Norma's just bleeding like crazy. Well, we sent him to the medical aid to get taken care of. And, so, Coach being what he was stout. We came out to, we played on, and we remember who the guy was, and so when he came to bat the next game, the next time, next inning or so, Coach walked out to the mound, and he brought all the infield together, and he says, "Now, what I want you to do," he says, "I want you to put the first pitch right in that guy's head. I want you to hurt him." And he says, "I don't want anybody here. If he charges the mound, nobody's to move. Nobody's to move. I will take care of it. And if he doesn't come out, that's fine. But you just keep throwing till you hit him, okay?" And we had a guy that threw pretty damn hard. And so what was going to happen, we looked over to Al, and he was up on top of the dugout,
Yep.
And he was going to do. He was going to waylay him from the side, I guess you'd call it it would have been a clip in football. And, he was going to take care of him right there on the infield. And so he came up to bat. The coach over there called him out of the game, and that was the end of that. And the funny part. It's that Norman was sleeping in a bunk with me that night. He was above me. He was below me. Well, I got up in the middle of the night to go make a head call about 3 in the morning. And Norman had come back all bandaged and stuff, and he was asleep. And I got down to go make a head call, and he wasn't there. And I went out to the building, when they're in their quarters there, and he wasn't there. So I said, "Coach, Norman's not here." And Norman was from Irving too. We played ball together. Norman was quiet, but you didn't mess with Norman. He'd be one that he'd get you. So sure enough, we went out and we looked for him, and we called security and said, "Well, we got him over here at the police station." What have you got him over there for? Well, he went over to and beat this guy up about something that happened on the baseball field, and he went over there and beat him up. And we had to go over there and drag him off, and we got him here locked up. We were just fixing to call you, have you come pick him up. So what Norman did, he found out where he was, and we just went over and beat the hell out of him.
He handled it separately.
He took care of it himself, all bandaged up, and went over and got the guy in bed. And he said, I don't know, and I just beat him up. So, you know, we had great fun. You know, we were playing Baylor, and Baylor, we were a bunch of jerks. We were about the University of Dallas was Catholic, and they were Baptist. And
right.
They just didn't like it. They could give us a bad time. So a couple of our guys took some shoe polish, and this is at the Florida tournament, and they had their uniforms out hanging on the line, and they took their shoe polish and went out on the back of their jerseys. They wrote UD. On all of them. So we played them the next game, and they had UD written on the back of the jerseys.
Bet they were mad.
Who was mad was our principal.
Uh-oh.
And not principal, but our president.
Yeah.
Because University of Dallas was an intellectual-type school, and I learned what pseudo-intellectual meant there. and we had to pay for all those and so forth.
Uh-oh.
And
you guys were supposed to be better than that?
Yeah, we were at their baseball. Well, 4 years later, they dropped us. And, in fact, when we had, we ended up going to NAIA conference playoff the next year, the president came down and said, I want you to reduce your schedule to 13. And this whines away, school is getting better known for the baseball than they are the other.
And so he decided
Coach left.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, right. And
he left, and he had dropped all the scholarships. And it was so sad because a lot of the kids that come here, freshmen and sophomores, now they don't have scholarships. Now they got to go somewhere else.
Right.
And as a result, Dallas Baptist University over here got a bunch of boys, our guys, and started a program. And now they have probably one of the best baseball programs in Texas. They had sent several to the majors, and I remember the time the president of SMU came over here to watch us play SMU, and while he's over there, he said, I'd like to meet the president of your school, and we sent a runner up there to get the president, Dr. Cowan, asked him to come down. He said, I don't go to those games. If he wants to meet me, he's got to come up here. So, what a jerk. And Dad, my father was the president of the Irving Chamber of Commerce, and he went out there and talked to the president, Dr. Cowan, and said, you know, we ought to do a joint venture here. Let us join hands, and we can help you, and you can help us. And today, that's a major, that's a major deal. You know, the public relations person of the school is the president of the chamber.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a big deal between the two.
Mm-hmm.
And University said, no, we work primarily with Dallas. We don't, you know, do anything. You guys basically escorted to the door. He basically escorted Dad to the door.
He sounds
I got to get back to tell you about Dad. He's what time he did something for me. I'll never forget that. I was a senior, and I slid into second, and I actually broke a bone in my ankle in which I could not go up on my toes, but I could walk. And when I run on my toes.
Mm-hmm.
Good runners run on their toes. And so the coach came out there, and he was a football coach, and I could walk around there on toes, and I couldn't run. And he just did a number on me and told me, get off the field, you know. And embarrassed me, and really hurt me because, I was ready to play. You know, I loved the game.
Right.
And Dad was over there, and so I went home, and I was really upset. I went to the hospital that night, and they had to look at it because it's swollen. It took x-rays, and the doctor that was there checked it out and said, well, you just got a bad sprain, you know, going home. And about 7:30 next morning, that doctor called and said, no, you need to come on here. You got a broken bone. And so I came on there, and I got a cast. I went on up there.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to school, and my first class was back behind, close to the football coach's office. And I was going around, looked around, and I saw Dad's car there. And my best buddy was there, and I said, hey, Dad's out there. And I said, I wonder what he's doing out there. I said, let's go out and see. And Charlie says, hey, I know your dad. You better leave things alone. And I'll be darned. I came out of my first class, and there's that coach. And I don't want to talk about somebody did a 180.
Hmm.
Hey, Gary, how you doing? How you feeling? You know, needing help getting around, you know? I mean, he must have really got in his britches, you know. And that always impressed me about Dad. That just, and the games, you know, one time I hit a ball, I guess my greatest thrill, we beat Texas, and I hit a home run in the last inning.
Mm.
Here, this little old school, 500 people, beat Texas, and I hit a home run. And I came off, and he was sitting over there, and I went over past him, and it really hurt me. He didn't say anything like, nice hit, you know, I'm proud of you, or he was clapping or anything. He was just sitting there keeping score.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, be sure to get your studies done. And that was all, and that hurt. Well, what I didn't know was the minute we got back home that night, he called all the newspapers and told them what I had done. And I called, and then it came out the next morning, the Herald and all the papers. I said, hey, Coach, how'd you get that so fast? He says, I didn't call him. I said, who called him? He said, your dad did. So, you know, he would tell people what a good ball player I was, but he never would say it to anybody else.
Well, it also sounds like he was concerned that you study, too.
He was concerned I'd become a... His worst thing he could call me was a showboat.
Mm.
Boy, he called me that one time, and, that really hurt. And I quit doing what it was I was doing.
Mm-hmm.
And you got to quit showboating out there in the field. And I said, oh, what's showboating? You know. So, anyway, I admired him as a patriot. When I was in Vietnam, he sold flags, and I got this story from the police. Some hippie came in there and wanted to buy a flag.
Mm-hmm. And came into his store?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And Dad wasn't going to sell it to him. He wouldn't know what he was going to do with it. And he got in this humongous argument,
uh-huh.
You know, about you can sell him the flag without saying, you know, and they got this big argument. And Dad was going to, you know, physically going to throw him out of the place. And the secretary called the place. He came out there and got this guy and threw him out, you know. But he wasn't going to sell him that flag because, you know, he's afraid he's going to burn it, see?
Mm-hmm.
And I always thought that was I thought that was neat. And he never, ever said anything about being proud that I'd joined the Marine Corps or I'd gone to Vietnam. Never said anything to me. And when I left to go to Vietnam and I left love, I guess it's typical about every father and son, you know, is went down, hugged mom and hugged sister and came to Dad, and I almost broke down. I almost cried. We just looked at each other, and I turned around and walked away. I was fixing to cry. And
you didn't shake hands or anything?
No, just walked away.
Mm-hmm.
And that feeling was there. And I understand when I was overseas, he arranged to read so many pages of the Bible each day through the tour. And it was so funny. My mother said they got in a discussion. She heard it that if you got hurt or killed, that the Marines would come knock on your door, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, you know. So she told Dad, she says, I want you to remove the doorbell. Why? She says, well, I don't want the Marines come ringing the doorbell. And he said, well, they'll just knock on the door. And she says, well, I want you to remove the front door. You know, she just She was a wonderful mother. I mean, she just loved me. I want you to remove the front door. And she said, well, I can't remove the front door. People can just walk in, you know. Well, I don't care. I want you to remove that front door. I don't want them. I heard that story. I just love that story. And,
well, Gary, let me ask you, when did you leave University of Dallas?
When did I leave?
Yeah. Did you graduate?
No, I didn't graduate. Uh-huh. I like 2 years of Spanish. I just couldn't deal with Spanish.
Okay.
I just couldn't handle it.
Uh-huh.
So I transferred on to North Texas, and I graduated the next year.
Which was?
65.
Okay.
And that's where I saw the Marines land at Da Nang. And
on TV, you mean?
On TV, yeah. I can remember the day I saw it. I was in the chow hall watching them land. And, I also got to tell you one funny thing, too.
Mm-hmm.
I was in my last game I played, we were in a conference, and I always hoped that I had a chance of playing some pro ball, but somewhere I hope somebody would watch it. There were scouts up there. And this guy came up behind me, and I was untying my shoes, and he said, son, are you married? And I said, he said, son, you got any kids? I said, no, sir. He said, are you married? And I said, no, sir. And he says, he handed me his card. He says, call me when you get back. And he was at the Cubs. And I turned to my buddy. I said, what the hell is he talking about? Call me when you get back. And he says, hey, there's a wharf, folks. There's a wharf going on. And he said, you're fixing to be 4A. And the first time I thought about it, the real world, you know, the real world out there.
Yeah.
And saw the thing on the dang, and then I started to think about what I was going to have to do, and the recruiters knocked on my door.
Did they really?
Yeah, they were going around the place I was staying in, and I love the Blues. I mean, God, it goes back to beginning of time. The Blues sell themselves. You know, and I talked to them, and one of the reasons I joined them was when I played college ball, I never missed a game,
right?
And I always wanted to hit leadoff, and leadoff, most guys don't want to hit leadoff. It takes a particular person. Coach told me later, he said, to find somebody that wants to hit leadoff. Because, you know, it's like standing. It's like a lot of people don't want to sit on the front row.
Right.
Nobody wants to be the first one to do something or whatever. They want to be the fourth, fifth one back.
Mm-hmm.
But I always loved being the first one there because I like to get things going. And I always like to screw the pitcher up as much as I could, you know. I mean, I'd like to get in close to the plate and see if he could hit me. Or, you know, I would try to foul off as many as I could. You know, I just loved to, you know, the pitcher and me were at war, you know. And then when I got on first, it was me and the pitcher, and then it was me and the catcher in the second one. And it was just these little wars. I just, you know, I loved it. But I loved to be the first one to get this thing started.
Mm-hmm.
One time I bunted my cell phone after I got this guy, fouled this guy off many times, and then I finally got him to throw at first base so many times that he finally threw it away, and I went to second, and I got on second, and I was bouncing around, and the guy turned around and actually threw the ball over the shortstop's head. Wrong place. I went to third. And the coach took the pitcher out. I had him so flabbergasted that he actually got taken out. I had him taken out. But that was my greatest thrill. You know, I mean, we had them going before the game was over going. So anyway, I joined the Marines because they kept saying, we're the first ones in. We're the first ones in everything. I said, hey, that's me.
That sounds like me.
That's me. You know, I mean, what do you mean you're the first one? We're the first ones in always.
Well, when did you sign up?
That year.
65.
In that fall,
mm-hmm.
or that spring, or in that way. And I spent the next 5 or 6 months running. I weighed 129 pounds. I stood 5'10". I was just a stick.
Mm-hmm.
I barely made it in the weight category to go in the service. And, but, you know, I would, that's why I played. That's why I was skinny all the time. And it was part of that ADD,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Mm-hmm.
I ran everywhere. I couldn't walk. And so I went in, and I could run. Before I went in, I could run 5 miles forward and 5 miles backwards carrying 50 pounds without stopping.
Good Lord.
My upper strength was real good.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you got in there, the boot camp, I could run with them. But the Marines had a way of getting you. They could see it. So what they would do, they would make you walk fast. They wouldn't let you run. And these DIs could do that. And that, they killed me. They absolutely walked me in the ground. You know, I couldn't go 100 yards. You know, you ever tried walking fast?
Yeah. It's a whole different, the muscles are completely different.
Yeah, I mean, it's
mm-hmm.
hard.
Mm-hmm.
You can't, I mean, you bust your rear end walking fast. And then when I got up to do the pull-ups, they saw I was really banging them out, so what'd they do? They made me reverse hands. It's a whole different set of muscles.
You mean crossover?
Instead of having a muscle, mm-hmm. have the hands facing you, mm-hmm. they made you turn down and do the hands that look the other way.
Mm-hmm.
That's a completely different set of muscles. I did a half of one, I loved it. Then, boy, it's screaming at me.
Now, what would they scream at you?
Oh, lots of nice things. I can't remember. that was the time when they could use profanity. They can't use profanity now.
Right, they have to be more clever.
But they can, they'll get you.
They would spew out whatever came to mind, probably.
Yeah, well, basically, their deal was, you think you're going to be a lieutenant or a Marine officer. You came in here to be a Marine officer. You were a candidate,
Yeah.
And they would just make you terrified of you're not going to make it. And it worked, And the guys who thought, and most of them were from California. I heard them on the bus coming to California that, that's a piece of cake, They were gone the first 3 days,
Gone meaning they washed out?
Yeah.
They just
quit.
Left, yeah.
They just quit,
Yeah.
And that's where we lost a lot. They just quit. And so...
Now, why did you not quit?
I wanted to be a lieutenant. I did not want to go home as anything but an officer of Marines.
Mm-hmm.
I was going to be an officer of Marines. And that's all there was to it.
And since you had your degree, that was going to be possible. If you since you had a degree and been to college, it would be possible for you to be an officer.
That gave me the capability to be an officer. And that's what I told these kids at school, have a backup plan. Go to school and get a degree.
Yeah.
And I tell this thing when I get how I got into the art field,
Yeah.
I didn't get to play first base for the New York Yankees, but I got I got my college degree, which led to the point that I became an officer in the Marine Corps, which gave me, and I'll get into the art here later, it led to this other thing. And that's how I got into there as a lieutenant. And
let me just for listeners to clarify, you did your basic training at Quantico.
Yes.
And once that was completed and you hung in there, what is it, 10 weeks or so?
It was 10 weeks.
Something like that, yeah. And then they needed to send you for further training.
Yeah, basic school. They gave you about 2 weeks off, and then you came back. You were a lieutenant, and they sent all the lieutenants to basic school, which is dormitory, and it was the coldest winter in 27 years of Virginia. And here's where you learned leadership. You learned how to land navigate. You learned how to call in air support, mortars. You get to use all the firearms. You qualified with your rifle, and it was hard.
Did you spend some time in the classroom and some time out on the field?
Yeah,
out on the ranges.
Yep,
and so on?
50-50, and
uh-huh.
and I wasn't impressed with basic school. In fact, it was we talked about this when we went back to the reunion about 3 years ago. We went back to basic school and we talked to the CO and. We told him about what we had, and he says, no, it's just that, it was terrible. In fact, I have a copy of the CO's address to us at mess night. In other words, about the last two or three nights that you're there at basic school, right before you graduate,
mm-hmm.
you have a mess night in which you put on your blues and you learn how to have, you know, how to conduct yourself as an officer when you're eating in your blues. You know, you don't eat, pick up your fork until your guest does.
Sure, some etiquette.
Yeah, which fork you pick up.
Mm-hmm.
Make sure you don't stick it in somebody's head like you do Bomberton. And you go all this, and let me get to tell you about the Civil War.
Okay.
And so, I got a copy of that. And I tell you, the first thing out of his mouth was, you know, he said, you know, I tell you what, of all the jobs I could get in the Marine Corps, this is the worst job I ever got. You know, and he listed all the jobs he got and all the ones he went. And he said, this is the one they gave him. You know, that's a hell of a thing for a CO to say. You know, I got the
it's
worst
not
job.
Very inspiring.
I ended up being a principal for a bunch of lieutenants. I want to go back to war, and I'm over here, you know, doing that. You know, and that tells you the attitude right there, that there was a problem.
Mm-hmm.
And so during basic school, they didn't really give you enough. And I remember one night in particular, how bad it was. We went on a march, and then we came back, a long march, which stayed overnight. And we marched some more, and the next night, afternoon, we marched back to a hill where there were some bleachers. And we were there supposed to meet some trucks, cattle, what we call cattle trucks, to take us back to the basic school.
Mm-hmm.
And we were all wet, you know, from marching, and it was cold. The wind was blowing, and we sit up in those bleachers for about an hour, and it just got cold, and they never showed up. So most of us got down off the bleachers, got down on the side of a hill, and just huddled up together because we were freezing. And so they didn't show up for about 5 hours. So we got in and went back, and about 2 hours later, it's time to get up.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody got up out of the dormitories. And the DIs came through there. Not the DIs, but the, what they were called, platoon commanders. They were captains. They came through there banging on the doors, telling us to get up to fall out for formation. And there's only very few of us that did. I was one of them. And I could remember the guy banging on my bunk, you know, do it. And a lot of guys fell out and went to sick call because most of them had already were just, you know, they were sick.
Oh, I can well believe it.
Someone got pneumonia.
Yep, pneumonia, exposure,
so, yeah.
Yeah,
and so we went out formation, and, you know, there were about six of us, and, boy, they screamed and yelled at us, and those guys are in bed, you know, they really were going to write you up, you know. And so anyway, I forgot what happened. About 2 weeks later, we had decided we were going to the rifle range, and we decided that there were two companies of us, and I think we told the other company what we were going to do, and I think they did the same thing. So we got to the rifle range, and this is how your company was graded. You know, the captains and the base commander, everything was graded on how well you did, and the Marines are graded on, you know, you want to be great shots, you know. That's how Marines are supposed to be great shots.
Yeah.
And we got out there and said, by God, we're going to pay them back on that. Yeah. So when it came down to the shot, we shot birds, trash cans, anything, leaves, bushes, anything you could think of. We didn't hit the target. I mean, if it's, if you shot, didn't miss, and you missed, there was a, on the end target down there was a white rectangular flag.
Mm-hmm.
Made of wood that they fly, you know, they fly over the target.
All right.
And there were about eight of them. And that's all you saw down there. It was just white flags all afternoon because nobody was even hitting the target. They wouldn't even hit the thing. and boy, they could see what we were doing. They were torqued, and they marched us back down there. And finally, I forgot how they found out they did it while we were doing it. And, base commander went nuts, and he called us all in, and and did a number on it. She goes, you couldn't talk back. You know, if you talk back, you know, you could be relieved of duty.
That's right.
And somebody had guts enough to request mass with his boss. It's a formal thing you can do.
Now, explain for someone who doesn't know what that is. What is it?
Request mass is where you can talk to your boss. If you're aboard ship, okay, you can request mass to talk to the captain. Or
without
talking to your superiors. They're superiors. You want to talk to the boss.
You can go around the chain
Everybody.
Of command.
And if you're having a problem with your captain, with your boss, and you know he's a problem child too, you can request mass with his boss. Anybody you want to. You can actually request mass with the Commandant of the Marine Corps if you want to. Hard to do. But you basically want just going to go up to the person above.
Right.
So he did. He went up there and told him what the problem was, what he'd been going through, you know, and terrible training that we've been receiving and all this sort of thing. And so anyway, I think he got his butt chewed and whatever. And then came back. Things got better. But I noticed one thing. This was 1960. Guess what happened about 100 years earlier? 1860.
Fort Sumter was fired on.
That's right. The Civil War was just if you think back, was only 100 years earlier.
That's right.
And I want to tell you something.
Okay.
The Civil War was alive and well. For most of us had never been out of state. And it didn't take long before people were calling Johnny Reb the Yankee.
Is that right?
Yeah, even though we were all college graduates and known better, in our particular class, and I think it was common amongst everybody else, there are a lot of Texans who joined up. And I think that's true of any war.
Yes, I think so.
And a lot of Marines come from Texas. A lot of Mexican-Americans join the Marines. But there just seems to be overabundance that joined the Marines from Texas. And I don't know how many guys in our group got called Tex, you know. And you got tired of it. But the Civil War was alive and well.
Well, how did it go with African-American guys?
We didn't have any.
None?
Well, I think in my basic school class, we had two. I'm sorry, in my boot camp, we had two.
Wow.
And I think that was about the average. Out of 40, there were in my group, we had two. So there were just a few.
How'd they get along?
Fine.
What about...
I don't know how they got along with the you know, guys up above. As far as I know, I got along with them fine.
Right.
The ones I didn't have problem... The ones I had a problem with was the damn Yankees that kept calling in. And I wasn't there to start the deal. You know, just quit calling me that, you know.
And so these guys from up north were,
in there. I remember one guy kept making fun of the way I talked. And when finally one day he kept saying, he talked about Cuba. And I'm going, so one day I'm going to go to Cuba. They're calling it Cuba. And I laid into him. I went back to Q last night. I went through that damn dictionary. I couldn't find Cuba anywhere. Where the hell is Cuba? I said, I know where Cuba is, but where the hell is Cuba? You know, and you keep talking about you're going to get an idea. What the hell is an idea? Yeah. I don't know what an idea is. What the hell is an idea?
You let him have it.
Yeah, and I just, you know, nailed him to the wall. He didn't bother you anymore after that. And, you know, and it mostly came from the Boston side, the Boston people. They were the ones that used to drive me nuts.
Boston.
And, Boston, you know, they did talk about the way we talk. And I said, hey, you know, get a grip.
Well, you were saying, Gary, that the content of basic school wasn't really enough to keep you guys, like, I don't know, not occupied, but keep you moving forward in terms of learning and everything.
No.
So,
of course, a lot of us from there went to whatever school you were going to, supply school or infantry school, and that's where you really learned what you needed to know.
Okay.
And
how was that determined, who went where?
You had a choices, three choices, and what you wanted to do, and then they would, the CO and the platoon commanders would decide what you wanted.
Mm-hmm.
Coming out of management, I decided I wanted to supply because I wanted to have that as a backup when I got out of the Marine Corps.
That you could get a civilian position?
Yeah, and that's what I wanted. And I knew I wasn't good enough. We had done some field training for infantry, and I just knew right off the bat that I was not that good or had the qualifications to be a grunt. Or whatever.
Which would take what? What was it that you thought you didn't have?
The biggest problem was navigation at night. Land navigation at night.
Mm-hmm.
What we only had at the time was a compass. And it was, when you took out your compass, you had a little night light pop through. And what we had to go through, you know, in the country. And you had a bunch of guys behind you, and they told us, you know, this is the only way you will go on patrol. You know, you don't go by lakes, ponds, and trees and whatever. You might during the day, but at nighttime, you got to use that compass. And that just terrified me because I just knew I couldn't do it.
That wasn't going to be your...
That scared me.
Your specialty, yeah.
I just knew I couldn't find those points. You know, you'd have to walk 300 meters at certain degrees, and when you got to that point, you would check in, and you better be at that point, because if you got yourself in a bind and you need to call in an artillery strike,
right,
it would work off where you were, you know.
Right, which
and yeah. I need some rounds 200 meters east where I am.
Right, the errors could be really bad.
You weren't in the right place, and that happened a lot.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, in Vietnam, that's why we lost a lot of lieutenants. Mm-hmm. Lieutenants just went.
Yeah,
I mean, they went fast over Vietnam, and you talk to guys in infantry who went to infantry school and all that.
Mm-hmm.
They'll tell you that they didn't learn. You just forget what you learned. You know, you had to. Little book that you kept that basic five rules and things you got when you want to get a brief on something, and that was just kind of like a pilot's book when you went to check out your aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're about to fly. You know, you do all these checks. You know,
yes,
through the book.
Sure.
Well, you did kind of the same thing here, but every commander did it a different way, and you eventually just forgot it, and what they told me. And then when I ended up doing it on patrols,
mm-hmm.
they told me what they wanted to do. I just did what they told me. You know. And